Bearing in mind that I have only 55 minutes to speak, I find myself perplexed as how to proceed. Prejudices regarding the present topic are rather widespread, and fit into narratives of the history of philosophy, and even accounts of the entirety of Western history, that are at times bizarre. Good examples of this sort of thing are available in much popular writing on religion, politics, and ostensibly, philosophy. John Milbank, Catherine Pickstock, and even in his earlier writings, Alastair MacIntyre, each suggest that Duns Scotus's philosophy and the doctrine of univocity in particular are responsible for shifts in theological thinking that led either to a declination of Western theology, or the onset of the Reformation, or the coming of modernity. The most grandiose recent effort along these lines is perhaps that of the historian Professor Brad Gregory at Notre Dame, who in his widely and wildly acclaimed narrative, The Unintended Reformation, How a Religious Revolution Secularized Society, has at this SCOTUS introduced the introduction of the doctrine of univocity of being altered the metaphysical outlook of Western culture in such a way as to pave the way for the Reformation and eventually modernity and all of its ills. This really is a bit much, I must say. Besides, apart from its postmodern kitsch and substitution of the questionable category of genealogy for genuine history, the whole effort of these works is about four centuries too late. It was precisely calumnies of this sort that led the Franciscan order to assemble an editorial team in the 1620s under the leadership of Father Luke Wadding at San Isidore in Roma, and published Scotus's writings in a comprehensive, if scientifically unsatisfactory, edition for the very first time. Meanwhile, there's a group of serious scholars carefully documenting what analogy is for Aquinas, what univocity is for Scotus, and how the two major figures may be said to agree or disagree. These are the scholars whose works I've consulted as secondary sources in preparing my remarks. No philosophical scholar or historian of philosophy of my acquaintance would cite, apropos of Scotus at least, in a serious vein any of the quote-unquote scholarship referred to in the previous paragraph. And if you have come here today to hear what Noon or someone else has to say about such opinions, you are growing to be gravely disappointed. Perhaps it's a waste of your time to stay. Or perhaps you ought to hear what the historical and systematic situation is on these matters. My efforts this afternoon are going to be focused upon capturing much of the substance of what Aquinas and Scotus have to say on the themes of the lecture. My inclination will furthermore be towards summarizing Aquinas' views systematically rather than delving into the stages of the development of his views on analogy in the fashion that Bernard Montagne does in his excellent monograph. I think I can rely upon my audience's knowledge of Aquinas being broader than their knowledge of Scotus. We shall begin naturally with St. Thomas's text on analogy, treating his thought in three different sections: predicamental analogy, Aquinas' influence on the 13th century discussion of semantic analogy, and finally transcendental analogy. Thereafter, we shall sketch out quite briefly Henry of Ghent's theory of analogy, so as to render the text we shall consider from Scotus more intelligible. Next, we shall consider Scotus' views on analogy and univocity, beginning with the general treatment of the topic of univocity of being in some classic texts, followed by a discussion of logical univocity and the problem of epistemic access, and finally, why Scotus considers univocity essential for both philosophical and theological knowledge. Finally, we shall step back from the two main figures we've considered and try to draw some general conclusions about where they agree and where they disagree. Aquinas on predicamental analogy. Aquinas deals with the analogy of being in several places in his corpus at two different levels, a so-called predicamental level and a transcendental level. At the predicamental level, Aquinas is treating the way in which being may be predicated amongst the categories of being into which ens commune is divided, substance and the nine accidents. At the transcendental level, Aquinas is interested in the ways in which being may be predicated of substance, and in particular, the ways in which terms such as being and others may be extended to God, the ultimate substance. In some texts, such as the early De Principiis Naturae, which is probably before he finished redacting his sentences, we find Aquinas paraphrasing Aristotle's treatment of cross-hand equivocals rather closely, but in clear dependence upon Averroes Commentarium Magnum in Metaphysics, Book 4, Chapter 1. Aquinas uses the example found in Aristotle's texts, the examples of health and medicine, and elaborates how the terms health and medical may be expressed of different items, themselves not the same, but nonetheless in reference to one thing. And this is text one on your hand. To understand this business, that is, of how things may be numerically, specifically, generically, and analogically one, we should note that something may be predicated of many in three different ways, univocally, equivocally, and analogically. Something is univocally predicated, which is predicated according to the same spoken term, using the same notion, that is, definition. As, for example, animal is predicated of man and ass. For each of them is called animal, and each is of the soul and substance capable of sensation, which is the definition of animal. Something is predicated equivocally, that's predicated of some things according to the same spoken term, but according to a different notion, as dog, instead of what is capable of barking, and of the dog star in the heavens above. These two things do not agree in definition, or what is signified, but only in name, for what is signified through a spoken term is the definition of the thing, as is claimed in Metaphysics 4. Something is said to be predicated analogically, which is predicated of many items whose notions are different, but they are attributed to some one thing that is the same. For example, when health is said of the body of an animal, of a urine sample, and of a medical infusion, the spoken term does not in all these cases establish the understanding of the same thing in all respects. Notice how translated signify, establish the understanding, right? Most people don't understand that meaning is a bad translation of significare. Because meaning is in your head. Constituere intellectum is to establish an understanding within a community. It's objective, it's real as rain. Constituere intellectum. So bear that in mind. And be suspicious when people start translating significare as meaning in the abstract. It's almost bound to get things wrong. So I keep very objective, close to Boethius here. Constituere intellectum. All right. where was I? Yes. Essentially the same thing in all respects. For health, is said of the urine sample as a sign of health, of an animal body as of the subject of that health, that is healthy, and of the medical infusion of something able to cause health. But nonetheless, all these notions are attributed to one end, namely health. For sometimes the things that, which agree according to analogy, that is in proportion or comparatively or by an agreement, are attributed to one end, as is clear from the example above. Sometimes they're attributed to one agent, as medical is said of the person who acts through the art of medicine, of the midwife who acts without the knowledge of medical science, and of the instruments they use, but through attribution to one agency, which is the art of medicine. Sometimes they're said through attribution to one subject, as being a set of substance and quality and quantity, and the other categories, for it is not in all respects the same notion by which a substance is called being, and a quantity and other things, but all things are called being in the fact that they are attributed to substance, which is the subject of them all. And for that very reason, being is said in a prior manner of substance and in a posterior way of the other things, and for that reason, too, being is not a genus of substance and quantity, since no genus is predicated by way of priority and posteriority of its own species, rather being is predicated analogically. And this is what we have said, that substance and quantity differ by genus, but are the same by analogy. One quote. Now, pretty clearly, in this text, Aquinas is not dealing with either semantic analogy, the analogy of words and or concepts, or metaphysical analogy, the ways in which things are arranged in priority, posteriority, and the ontological order, in mutually exclusive ways, but rather in a complementary fashion. His appeal, for example, to health as predicable of the urine sample or the medical infusion is dealing with the way the term health may be predicated of things quite different from each other, but is related to a third item, which in this case he characterizes as their end. Much the same could be said of his treatment of medical, though there the agency is the common element behind the attribution. When he applies the analogical model predication to being, Aquinas emphasizes that the items attributed to substance, the primary instance, are attributed to it as to a subject. Aquinas' influence on the topic of semantic analogy. Before we enter into that part of analogy which is transcendental rather than predicamental, we should spend some time with a text much discussed by Professors Ashworth, Donati, and Pini, for it directly impacted the development of semantic analogy in the second half of the 13th century. The text in question is taken from St. Thomas' Sentences commentary, where Aquinas is answering the question whether all things are true by the uncreated truth. Book 1 of the Sentences, distinction 19, question 5, article 2, the response to the first objection. And this is the second text on your hand. To the first, we should say, accordingly, that something is said according to analogy in three ways. Either it is said analogically according to notion only, and not according to being, and this is when one notion is referred to many items by way of priority and posteriority, though that notion only has being realized in one of the items, as is the case with the notion of health being referred to animal, urine sample, and diet in different ways according to priority and posteriority, but not according to diversity of being, for the being of health is only found in the case of the animal. Or something is said analogically according to being and not according to notion, and this happens when many items are equal in the notion of something common, but that common item does not have being of one sort in all of them, as is the case where all bodies are equal in expressing the notion of bodiliness, corporeitas, whence the logician, who considers only notions, claims that the name body is predicated univocally of all bodies, but the being of the bodily nature is not of the same sort in bodies subject to corruption and those not. Whence, too, so far as the metaphysician or natural philosopher are concerned, who consider things according to their proper being, neither the same body nor anything else is said univocally of bodies subject to corruption and those not. This is clear enough from the philosopher and the commentator in the treatment of Metaphysics 10. Or something is said analogically of some items according to notion and according to being, and this is when things are not equal either in a common notion or in their being, as being is said of substance and accident, and about such things it is necessary that the common nature have some being in each one of the items about which the term is said, but the nature be different according to the feature of greater and lesser perfection. And likewise, I see that truth and goodness and all other notions of this sort are said analogically of God and creatures, whence it is necessary that all these notions be according to their being in God and in creatures according to a feature of greater and lesser perfection. Whence it follows that, since truths cannot be according to one being in the two cases of God and creature, there are diverse truths in the two cases. Unquote. The astute listener will have discerned, I'm sure, that St. Thomas does not place being with the type of analogy that is according to priority and posteriority here, but rather with the case wherein a nature is realized in greater and lesser perfection. Whatever interpretation we may wish to give of this discrepancy between the sentences in the De Principiis text, this handy and tidy list of types of analogy here in Aquinas' sentences commentary proved too much for later logicians to resist. Starting around 1280, logicians such as Simon of Faversham and the anonymous authors labeled C and SF, edited by Professor Stan Evison in the Corpus Philosophorum Danicorum series, gave a thorough analysis of the modes of equivocation and the modes of analogy in their questions and commentaries upon Aristotle's Physica Elenchi. Upon the topic of analogy, these logicians, partially inspired by Aquinas, distinguish three types of analogical terms: one that is actually univocal from a logical standpoint, one that is something in between, and one that is actually equivocal, logically speaking. An analogous term that is actually univocal is one that, like Aquinas' example of body, applied to both bodies, earthly and celestial, involves one formula, ratio, equally applicable to quite diverse things, whereas the entities in the world display that formula in drastically different ways, and hence diversely. Because they each, however, fit the ratio, whereas the degrees of perfection are diverse, the term applying them must be logically univocal, according to the common notion of univocal arising out of Aristotle's categories. The in-between type of analogy is the case of per prius et posterius. The ratio is found primarily in one item, and applied to the other item or items in a secondary fashion, derived from the ratio as applied to the first item. The example here is that of being, and like in Aquinas' sentences, this case is considered distinct from that of health, that is, distinct from the case of sanum or sanitas. As Professor Ashworth notes, moreover, the anonymous authors make quite a point of saying that the notion of being, ends, is a common and indeterminate notion, of itself indeterminate to ends in se and ends in alio, while setting Avicenna to the same effect. The final type of analogous term, that which is actually equivocal, is found in the case of health. There is no ratio common to the body of the animal, and the diet, and the exercise routine. Rather, there is an ordering of one to the other, inasmuch as one is applied primarily and simply, the ratio of a certain disposition in the animal body, and the other predications are following upon, or in reference to, that ratio, but do not express that ratio in their own right. Implicitly, then, there's more than one ratio, and that is tantamount to equivocal predication. Four further things in this connection. First, Simon of Faversham, whom Scotus follows quite closely in his logical commentaries, to give an idea how closely, at one point in the Porphyry commentary, he states four paragraphs right as Simon of Faversham. So, at Oxford when he's teaching, which is where certainly he taught the logical writings, they have Simon, they have the SF commentator, and they have the C commentator, for sure. How do I know that? Well, you get to a certain point in the lengthy commentary, and he goes through the objections he's listed above, and all of a sudden starts answering objections that aren't in the text anywhere, in any of the manuscripts. It took me 3.5 months to find this. But if you go through, he's answering point by point each of the objections in the SF commentary. So obviously his students have the SF commentary. So I can assure as I'm standing here, that's how sure we know that Don Scotus has Simon and C commentator and SF commentator. This is the point of historical research. A little plug. Four further things to note in this connection. First, Simon of Faversham, whom Scotus follows quite closely in his logical commentary, is strongly influential, positively and negatively, especially upon Scotus, on two points. He holds that there's no common ratio to being as divided into substance and accident. That is, that being is equivocal in the case of the division between substance and accident. But he also gives a rationale for why terms can be predicated per prius and posterius that Scotus will reject and continue to reject throughout his work. The latter is the claim that there is an isomorphic relation between the ordering of things and their being signified in a prior and posterior way. For Scotus, in a view first clearly expressed in his own commentary upon the Elenchi, this is not the case. For the signification has to do with the imposition of a name under a certain ratio, or notion. The notion in the mind of the impositor may be of something prior or of something posterior. But that is the ratio that we are given to understand, intellectum constitura, when the term is uttered. There is then no strict correspondence between the priority and posterior of nature and the priority or posterior of naming. For much the same reasoning, there can be no analogical terms if this is taken to mean per prius and posterius, since any term is imposed with a given ratio on the part of the impositor. If there are many such impositions, with corresponding many rationes involving the same sound, the term is equivocal. If there's only one, the term is univocal. Second, Scotus thinks the position just described is quite consistent with metaphysical analogy, in the sense of priority and posteriority of the order of things. He tells us quite clearly in the question cited from the Elenchi, quote, "Hence there can be analogy in reality, but in a meaningful sound there can be neither priority nor posteriority," unquote. Third, Scotus holds that in his earlier Elenchi commentary that being is equivocal, following the lead of Simon of Faversham. He makes this point explicitly in replying to an opening argument, the same question. I think this might be no, it's not. Sorry, I didn't bother with this. Whence, as the form of the argument, we should say that the first philosopher considers things according to their quiddities, and the order of reality matters stand in such a way that certain things have an order to each other. That's why the philosopher says that being is analogically said of substance and accident. But because the logician considers things as they fall under a ratio, the logician says that being is said equivocally of substance and accident. Of course, he has in mind Porphyry, who says this very thing. Fourth, from what we have seen, there are two traditions on the logical side going from Aquinas to Scotus in regard to what to make of the notion of being. One holds that being is equivocal, Simon of Faversham and Scotus himself in the Elenchi commentary. But the other holds that being is univocal and is determined to either substance or accident by something added to the notion of being. That's the anonymy of Evison and eventually Don Scotus. I might add, this presages what's going to happen with the concept of being about 1310, because those who hold analogy will be forced to hold, as Hervé Catullus was, as Gerard Bologna was, that being immediately is disjunctive, or is being a substance or accident. Nothing common in between. This is all, if you want to get the down and dirty on this, you want to read Peter Ariel, that's the guy to read on this. Or if you want to do the short course on this, read Stephen Brown's dissertation on Luden on this very point. He lays it all out. Okay, let's turn to Aquinas on transcendental analogy. The text upon which I shall focus our attention is, of course, the relatively late Summa Theologiae. Prima pars, question 13, asking about our ability to name God. The articles in this question are numerous and cover the theme from many angles, grammar, logic, and metaphysics. The most important article for our purposes is Article 5, which deals with the question of whether things said of God, and creatures may be said univocally or not. In his reply, Aquinas denies that anything can be predicated univocally of God and creatures. Comparing the case of creatures to that of effects incapable of receiving a likeness, the likeness of an agent in its fullness, and in particular, to the case of the sun producing effects multiform and diverse, unequaling the sun's own nature and form, Aquinas argues all creatural perfections, and Aquinas does mean to include here the so-called pure perfections, pre-exist in God, not in the divided way they do among creatures, but unitedly. What this means for divine naming is that although a name for a given perfection may pick out distinctly that perfection among creatures, that name cannot pick out such a perfection in God so distinctly because it does not enjoy that kind of distinction from the essence of God. This is text 3. But when we say this name, that is the name of wisdom, that's what he has in mind, we do not aim to signify something distinct from the essence and power and being of him, namely God. And so when the name wise is said of man, it delimits and encompasses after a fashion the thing signified. But this is not the case, however, when it is said of God. Rather, the name leaves behind the things signified, the res significata, as not grasped and exceeding the signification of the name. Whence it's clear that the name wise is not said of God and of a human according to the same notion, ratio. And much the same argument can be made regarding other names, whence no name is predicated univocally of God and creatures, unquote. Aquinas uses the term wise as his example, but we know from other texts that he considers wise to be a case parallel with transcendental, such as good, true, and unity, and in that the notion itself does not bespeak any imperfection. The curious business in this text is although the ratio, or perfection of wisdom, is commensurate with the wisdom of the wise man, or presumably the wise angel, and that is why the predication encompasses the res significata in that case, this parallelism utterly fails in the case of the predication of God. Often elsewhere, Aquinas makes a related but distinct point, namely that the concrete terms such as good bespeak a subject having a given property, whereas the corresponding abstract goodness captures adequately well the property in its purity, but implies that the res significata is that whereby something is. Yet both of these fail to get what we want in the case of God, inasmuch as God is subsistent as that, and thus is concretely the property of the perfection itself. In linguistics terms, this is a case parallel with white, a concrete accidental, and whiteness, an abstract accidental, and is usually expressed as the contrast between the res significata and the modi significandi. But here, it is precisely the res significata that breaks down when the term is applied to God. Because although the term belongs, absolutely speaking, in a prior manner to God than it does to the creature, the linguistic structures do not mirror this metaphysical, participational aspect, and the predication is accordingly inadequate. The predication more gestures at than expresses what it wants to say. Before we leave this text, note that there are implicitly two rationes involved in the case described. One is the operative one, derived from creatures. The other one is the one that's pointed to, but not accessed by human minds, which in the present case would be best described as something like wisdom in God. Analogy is spoken of a bit below this text that we've been analyzing, but between our text and the one formally presenting analogy, there's a review and criticism by St. Thomas of the position claiming that names said of God are said equivocally. What Aquinas faults the position for, namely the equivocist position, is undermining all knowledge of God, precisely because no knowledge can result from inferences exhibiting the fallacy of equivocation. We need to bear this point in mind, both when we get to Scotus' view and when we try to evaluate Scotus' and Thomas' positions. Aquinas is on record as holding that the analogical naming of God does not involve the fallacy of equivocation and does not undermine our knowledge of God. Analogy proper is presented by Aquinas in the last text we shall consider from him. This is text 4 in your handout. We should say, therefore, that names of this sort are said of God and creatures according to analogy, that is to say, proportion. This occurs in two ways in names. Either it happens because many items have a proportion to one, as health is said of medicine and of urine sample, insofar as each is an order and a proportion of health in the animal body. One of these is a sign of such health, the other its cause. Or it happens because one has a proportion or another, as health is said of medicine and the animal body, insofar as the medicine is the cause of the health in the body of the animal. And in this way, some things are said of God and creatures analogically, and not merely equivocally, and not univocally. For we can only name from creatures, as we pointed out above. Hence, whatever is said of God in creatures is said accordingly as there is an order of a creature to God as to its principle and cause, in whom all perfections pre-exist most excellently. And this type of commonness is midway between pure equivocation and simple univocity. Nor in the case of things said analogically is there one notion as in univocals, nor totally diverse notions as in equivocals, but the name that is said in many ways signifies diverse proportions to the same one same thing, some one thing, as health said of the urine sample, which signifies a body, a sign of the animal body, whereas health said of medicine signifies the cause of such health, unquote. We find here, once again, metaphysical analogy running in parallel with semantic analogy, but though in a slightly different way. Analogy involves proportion. Here, initially, Aquinas appeals to the types of proportion at work in the famous health example, initially used by Aristotle in connection with his cross-centered equivocation teaching. The terms involved are either many-to-one, urine sample and medicine as to health in the body, or one-to-one, urine sample to health in the body, medicine to health in the body. The multitude of terms involved is what makes analogy to be different than the case of univocity, but the ordering of one to another and the occurrence of the terms in a certain context means that these terms are not just pure equivocals, but which Aquinas probably has in mind, Boethius' case of equivoca a casu. I agree here with Monsignor Whipple that the one-to-one case is really at the heart of what Aquinas wants to say about analogical terms. But this is just where matters become unclear. We may consider the situation either from the viewpoint of logic or from the viewpoint of epistemic access. Logically, analogical terms, as depicted, seem to involve a cluster of names in a certain order. Though that linguistic situation may be described, there seems to be no one ratio answering back to it. Yet there is, in any given predication, a ratio represented in the predicate term set of a subject. By the looks of things, it is the ratio of the perfection is taken from the creature that is so predicated, albeit is gesturing towards the ratio of the perfection is found in God, where it is in a prior and infinitely more perfect manner. And it is this gesturing that qualifies the predication as analogical. This last point now leads directly to the question of epistemic access. However much, thanks to proofs of God's existence already being in place, we know about the radical ontological dependence of creatures upon God and their perfections being participated perfections, the predication of terms analogically, in Aquinas' thinking, does not mean that we are acquainted with the primary analogate, that is, the source of those creaturely perfections. No, all we know are the creaturely perfections, however inadequate they are expressing the divine ones. Yet each of the models of analogy proffered, yes, even the one-to-one model, involves some kind of adjustment or reference of one ratio to another, either through an appeal to causality or an appeal to participation, or both. Either the models of analogy are seriously structurally misleading, or perhaps more charitably, are themselves analogous, and we should have to accept this limitation. Or some kind of univocity is needed to explain how predication in this case works. Or we would have to allow some kind of epistemic access to the primary analogate. It is precisely this last option that Hinder of Ghent, the next theorist of analogy, will exercise. So Hinder of Ghent on analogy. If you don't mind, I've had to take some water. Even though a sketch of Henry's views may seem to be an intrusion in our discourse, it actually is not, for at least two reasons. First, the entire discussion of analogy in Scotus' works is lodged within the proximate context of considering Henry's theory of analogy. And as a result, some acquaintance with that theory is needed. Second, Henry represents some of the critical reflection done upon Aquinas' works in the last quarter of the 13th century, much of it asking questions about the epistemological foundations for natural knowledge, and consequently the knowability of the world and God through natural reason. Regarding the latter point, which I am partially treating in the book presently being written, the critical reflection in question ranged not only over the problem of analogy, but included issues such as the knowability of substance, the role of the agent intellect in abstraction, the status and function of intelligible species, if any such entities are posited, and the manner in which our intellects may be said to understand the singular. Henry's theory of analogy is completely embedded within his own account of both the proper object of and the first object of the human mind. The proper object of the human mind for Henry is truth, but this functions actually as the intention through which things are known. The first object of the human mind is being, but being in its utmost indetermination. Ens maxime indeterminatum is the Latin. Though we may simply take this is another case of the nigh on universal acceptance by scholastic authors of the Avicennian claim that being is the first thing known or impressed upon the intellect, Henry's interpretation of this claim is complicated. We first grasp being as ultimate indetermination, but being is so indeterminate in two senses, themselves distinct. It is either indeterminate negatively, namely as something to which nothing can be added, that is in fact the notion of God, or it is indeterminate privatively, that is something which is of itself so indeterminate that it needs to be added to, and that's the general notion of the creature. Consequently, for Henry, the first notion of being that we have really is in one respect a knowledge of God, under the formula of being most indeterminate. Indeed, this primitive natural notion of God is the key to the entire epistemological enterprise of Henry, inasmuch as all notions we form for any other entity can only be formed on the basis of this notion. Yet matters are not so simple. Once we begin to think about being, we actually come to distinguish between these two notions of being, the one that belongs to God and the other pertaining to the creature. On this ground, Henry emphatically denies that there's any really univocal concept common to God and creature. But he equally insists upon the claim that until we think carefully, we are apt to confuse these two most indeterminate concepts of being, resulting in a hybrid compound concept that enters back to no distinct reality. This is what Henry calls an analogical concept or a community of analogy. But even here, Henry's view is a bit elusive. He claims that we are apt to generate such an analogical concept, on the one hand, because the being of creatures really is derived from the being of God by way of participation and thus proportioned to him. But we also tend to confuse these two concepts of being because of their genuine similarity and proximity, as he says, to each other. This is why he will also say that the two concepts seem to be one. This is bothering you theoretically, you ought to. This is what bothered young Duns Scotus. John Duns Scotus on the Univocity of Being. When we turn our attention to Scotus's views on univocity and analogy, we need to bear in mind that the classic texts in which he presents those views are ones in which he gives his criticisms of the theory of the analogy of Henry of Kant that we have just sketched. But a broader context than this one also needs to be borne in mind. Book 1, Distinctions 3 and 8, especially Distinction 3, of his commentaries on the sentences and all the versions, are the texts in which Scotus lays out his elaborate theory of how the human mind works, what I have called elsewhere his transcendental and developmental psychology. Consequently, we should not be surprised that at the heart of Scotus's criticism of analogy as described by Henry are alternative solutions to the solutions given by Henry and Aquinas to these epistemological issues widely studied in late 13th century philosophy. And as a result, an alternative view emerges in Scotus of how the human mind works that's definitely different from both Henry and St. Thomas. Let's start with one of Scotus's classic texts, one that you may well have read or be familiar with if you've ever done any reading on Scotus's views on univocity. This is text 5. I say, secondly, that not only is God conceived of in a concept analogous to that of a concept of a creature, namely God is conceived in a concept altogether different from that of a creature, but also is conceived in a concept univocal to him and to creatures. And so to avoid any argument regarding the term univocity, I say a concept is univocal, which is one in such a way that its unity suffices to generate a contradiction when it is affirmed and denied of the same thing. Also, it suffices for functioning as the middle term of a syllogism, in such a way that the extremes of conclusion united to the middle term may be concluded to, united to each other, without any fallacy of equivocation. You see the worry about the fallacy of equivocation. This text clearly deals with transcendental analogy, to use termistic terminology, but affirms that in addition to analogical concepts, a univocal concept is needed to explain our natural knowledge of God. Mind you, the analogy under discussion in Henry's is Henry's doctrine, not St. Thomas's. But Scotus would have much the same thing to say, I'm sure, on both scores were he asked. Note, too, that Scotus is arguing for a univocal concept of being. Whereas whether Aquinas is dealing with the concept of being, or is dealing with being as a nature, is sometimes, as we've seen, unclear. Finally, the concerns here expressed by Scotus are clearly rooted in logic and a concern to secure inferences. in this case, inferences regarding God. But as we shall see, Skota sees his teaching regarding univocity being essential for even for our natural knowledge of the world. Now let's survey some of the reasons that Skota seduces to uphold his doctrine of univocity, and why he thinks it's necessary for sound philosophy and theology. The classic text in the Ordinatio lists 5 arguments on behalf of univocity, but only 4 such arguments are given in the slightly earlier lectura, and not all of them are the same in the 2 cases. I shall only mention those in the Ordinatio listing before examining one of them in more detail. The arguments Skota gives in the Ordinatio are 1, the proof from certain and doubtful concepts, 2, that no analogous concept in Henry's sense could properly be caused by the natural causes that prompt our intelligence, 3, were Henry correct, and we could delve down, sophotera, literally dig down, like digging a ditch. Henry has it, if you dig down the concept of being, you eventually get to God. So were Henry correct, we could delve down and reach our concept proper to God, that is under the concept being. Merely through the concept being, we would have a concept of God sufficient for us to know his triune nature, but this is clearly impossible. 4, either our pure perfection expresses a notion common to God and creature, and that's univocity, or it expresses a notion proper to the creature, but that can't be attributed to God, or it expresses a notion proper only to God, but at that rate, we're not attributing to God anything we find within the scope of creatures. Does anyone see the argument? Is that for the ratio that we affirm the predicate? We say God is just, God is good. What is that ratio behind that predication? And finally, if Henry were right, there could be an intuitive knowledge of God communicated by cognizing a most perfect creature, because that's where we can get to God, just by digging down. Of these proofs, Scotus emphasizes the importance of the first in the Ordinatio and elsewhere. Usually, he gives the example of the ancient philosopher. They each thought that they had reached the ultimate principle, or the first being. But they varied as to what precisely that was. Some holding it was air, others fire or water, others the infinite, or the one. But clearly when they thought of it as a being, they were certain of that idea. Though, because of the counter-arguments given by other philosophers, they could not be sure whether their particular description of the divine nature was correct. By analogy, Scotus argues, we may conceive of God as a being, even though we may not understand the divine nature entirely accurately. The concept through which we conceive of God distinctly must apply to God, namely being, but it must not be identical to that about which we are uncertain, for that would entail we were certain and doubtful about the very same concept. A similar example is sometimes given by him, for example, the Dhyana, and it's of light, which, ironically enough, still works. Light may be conceived of as a thing, but it's unclear in the physics of Scotus's day whether it's a substance or an accident, to go to our physics, whether it's a wave or a particle. The concept of light as a thing, accordingly, cannot be identical to the notion of light as a substance, or an accident, or a wave, or a particle, but must be univocally common and determinable to both. This is his famous argument of you can have to understand something as being without understanding what specificity. Logical univocity and epistemic access. The themes of logical univocity and epistemic access are prominent in many arguments connected to Scotus' theory of univocity, including the way he describes it himself. But so too are his comments about why univocity is needed by both philosophers and theologians. Let's take up the themes of logical univocity and epistemic access and then conclude with why Scotus thinks univocity is necessary. When commenting upon items such as equivocal and univocal causes, as well as the unity of the gamos, Scotus makes 2 fundamental points. First, univocity may be such that it entails both likeness in form and mode of being, or such that it only requires a likeness in form without any similarity in the mode of being. The second type of univocity, called by Scotus himself diminished univocity, is surely, as Dr. Garrett Smith points out, what Scotus means by univocity in the classic texts we've just examined. For Scotus emphatically denies that there's anything really common to God and creature, even when he affirms that the concept of being equally applies to God and creature. If you don't believe me, I'll quote you in the text in Latin. It's from Distinction 8, of course, Part 1, Question 3. A tertium patebi, in tertio articulo, quia deus et creator non sunt primo diversa in conceptibus, sunt tamen primo diversa in realitate, quia in nulla realitate conveniunt. In nulla realitate conveniunt. Yeah. Well, all those guys I said at the beginning, they don't seem to have read this. same thing for Scotus. I mean, if you read St. Thomas's theory of language in Scotus and start going along, of course you'll get what you want. But that's, to say the least, a legitimate procedure. It's not what Scotus means, that's for sure. Second, a similar point is made by Scotus in connection with objections arising from univocity, coming from the authoritative text in Aristotle, wherein the latter presents his theory of cross-equivocation, and similarly texts in which Aristotle denies unity of the reality of genus on the grounds that unity is so slight. So this is, I think, your text 6, yes, text 6. Quote, likewise, the philosopher says in Physics 7 that there's a genus, that in a genus there lie hidden equivocations. On account of these, there may not be comparisons legitimate at the level of the genus. But nonetheless, this is not a case of equivocation, so far as the logician is concerned, who posits diverse concepts for both species and genus, but it is a case of equivocation, so far as the real philosopher is concerned, for there's a lacking in this case of the unity of the genus, a unity of the nature. That is how all the authoritative texts taken from the physics and metaphysics can be explained that deal with this subject. There's equivocation in terms of the real diversity of the items in which there's attribution, but there is consistent with this a unity of a concept abstractable from all the items so diverse, as is clear in the example given above about the unity of the genus. I grant then that the entirety of what an accident is has an essential attribution to substance, yet from substance and accident, a common concept may be abstracted. This text is precisely parallel with how Scotus described univocity himself in his earliest treatment of the topic outside the logical ratings, namely question 21 of his questions on the Dion of Aristotle. And this is quote text 7. As for the claim of Porphyry, we should say that although he was a logician, nonetheless he said many things that don't pertain to logic, and this is especially true with respect to what he says about the categories. For being, inasmuch as it's predicated with the categories metaphysically or naturally, does not bespeak one concept, nor is it their natural genus or their metaphysical genus, but is nonetheless univocal, logically speaking. To the other point, taken from Metaphysics 4, we should reply that according to philosopher Metaphysics 4, it's not against the notion of a unity of genus that all the things pertaining to that genus be spoken of through attribution to one, as is clear regarding the genus of color, in which nonetheless all the species of color have an attribution to whiteness, which is the first and the measure of all colors. Although this is the medieval theory of colors, that white is the primary colors that he's talking about. And the case is similar in every genus, just as it's said in the same place. So too in the case at hand. All beings have an attribution to the first being, which is God, or if they are created beings, they have an attribution to substance. Nonetheless, despite this, from all these beings, one common concept can be abstracted that is signified by the name being, which is a univocal concept, logically speaking, though it is not such, naturally or metaphysically speaking. Quite clearly in these texts, Scotus has now changed allegiances, so to speak. Rather than agreeing with Simon of Faversham that being is immediately equivocal when it comes to dividing being and substance and accident, as he did in the Lanky commentary, Scotus has taken up the logical viewpoint on being associated with the anonymy, edited by Edison. In this rendering, being is univocal to substance and accident, the latter being determined to their specific content by their more exacting logical descriptions. But now we must ask why Scotus has changed allegiances. The answer is to be found in our second theme, that of epistemic access. A number of texts scattered throughout Scotus's corpus make roughly the same point. If being were not univocal, logically speaking, we could not justify or explain our knowledge of the substances that constitute the world, and we could not do the same with regard to our knowledge of God. Here's the way Scotus puts it in the Dion of Questions. And I think this is... Yes, that's text 8 on your hand. I prove that the concept of being is univocally common to substance and accident in the following way. If it were not, then we could not have any concept of a substance. Rather, we have a proper quantitative and intuitive concept about substance, or one that is abstracted. The first alternative fails, as shown above. That's where he gives things like the light analogy, but he also gives the Eucharist as examples, where clearly we don't immediately intellectually intuit substance. This is related, of course, to the discussion of whether substance has a spakias, an intelligible spakias in the intellect, right? So this, which he denies it does. our knowledge of substances for non-scope is inferential. That's why we have to study all those physical properties to get at what the nature of the thing is. The concept would have been to be abstracted from substance and accident and common to both. Yet there's no common concept in this fashion except for the concept of being, therefore, etc. This is typically what you get used to these lectures. So just follow and say therefore, etc. You have to work it all out yourself. But reading him is like, it took me years when I read him, it's just miserable. I mean, you have to constantly, with your footnotes, you know, you have to really watch, because he's not the kind of writer you're used to in St. Thomas. It's clear, moreover, that we cannot be aware of substance in the present life by a simple and primary concept, because all our knowledge originates in sense. Substance is not, however, sensible per se, and hence we cannot know it intuitively and by means of a simple concept. Rather, we must know it as follows. We abstract the concept of substance from the accidents we sense by saying that they are features of a being, and by further investigation, we discover that an accident is such a being that it inheres in another. The other being must be a subsistent entity, and hence we impose the name of substance on such a subsistent entity. And so we know substance in this confused way by combining subsistence with being, by saying that substance is a being that subsists in its own right, but we do not have an intuitive concept of it in the present life, whereby we know it as this being apart from the way it is described, as our experience teaches us. Unquote. Here's how he describes the need for univocity to justify philosophical theology in the Renatio, this is your text 9. The fourth argument regarding univocity is confirmed in the following way. Every metaphysical inquiry regarding God proceeds in this fashion. The inquirer considers the formal notion of something and removes from that formal notion any imperfection that it has in creatures. Then, reserving that formal notion and attributing it to it the highest perfection, the inquirer attributes it to God. An example could be taken from the formal notion of wisdom or intellect or will. These, of course, are among the pure perfections associated with Anselm. For each of these is considered in itself and according to itself, and from the fact that the notion so considered does not include formally any imperfection or limitation, all the imperfections concomitant with it in creatures are removed, and with the notion of wisdom or will maintained, these features are attributed to God in the most perfect degree. Therefore, every metaphysical inquiry regarding God presupposes that the intellect has the same univocal concept gotten from creatures. But if you say no, it's a different formal notion in the case of creatures, the case of creatures that belong to God. From this, there follows this problem. Out of no notion property, to features found in creatures, can we conclude anything about God? For the formal notion, the two cases are different. Nay, on this showing, we shall not conclude any more that God is formally wise from the notion of wisdom that we grasp in creatures than that God is formally a stone. Because stone is usually used as a metaphorical name, right? For some other concept can be formed of stone different from the one taken from a created stone, to which created stone has an attribution. A stone is a divine idea in God. And so formally, we can say, God is stone, according to this analogical concept, just as we say God is wise according to that analogical concept. Well, which I think this is very forceful to Henry Kent defenders, because what he's saying is that if you keep going the way you're going, we can't distinguish between pure perfections and mixed perfections, and hence we can't hierarchize our predicates of God. Scotus on one, why philosophy and theology require univocity. Scotus acknowledges in numerous places that his doctrine of univocity is opposed by many of his contemporaries, some of whom claim he is in a distinct, though parallel way to that claimed by radical orthodoxy folks, undermining the basis for philosophy and theology, as Professor Dumont has pointed out several times. In fact, this is a common place in Scotus. He'll say that everyone else disagrees with him. He's fully aware of it. It's not like he's not aware of this. Completely aware of this. Scotus himself makes a rejoinder to this sort of objection. And that rejoinder tells us a great deal about how he conceived the role of univocity within his own overall doctrine. This is, the final quote from your handout. Again, removing imperfection from creatures so as to arrive at a perfection in a certain way is a certain way to know God. Therefore, if a perfection that we know, thanks to our knowledge of God, is actually not of the same notion that we get from the perfection of creatures, in the end we shall have no knowledge of God. Nor will there be an essential relationship of a creature towards God. The theological masters, too, whenever they treat about God, or the things known about creatures and God, grant univocity in their teaching. They grant it in doctrina, though they deny this verbally. Now, if think about what he's saying. Is this something very important he's saying here? It's a methodological point he's making here. In other words, the condition for the possibility that they talk the way they talk is just that I'm right. Even though when I present it formally, they say it's not the case. This is what he's saying. And he says this very consistently in Lectura or Inagio several times. And then, of course, this is from Mary Dr. Presiansis. In light of this text, it's several parallels in the Ordinati and Lectura, particularly those in which Scotus talks about paying attention to how philosophers and theologians proceed. This is what he says several times in one of his longer texts, where he says that you have to watch how they proceed, how they reason. I think we can best understand the necessity of univocity for theologians and philosophers as a methodological claim. The actual pattern of reasoning engaged in by philosophers and theologians requires logical univocity, without which philosophy and theology would not fit the requirements for knowledge in the Aristotelian sense. In a sense, the univocity of being is about epistemology more than it's about metaphysics. That's why we get the recurring description of the doctrine as logical. Le bidon, as the French would put it. There's the balance sheet. Aquinas' doctrine of analogy is clearly a thorny matter, both for Thomists and non-Thomists. There are aspects of it that are semantic or logical, but others that are properly metaphysical. What Aquinas wants to hold, too, is the idea that creatures are effects of God and imperfectly represent his perfections. Their imperfect representations extend even to the so-called pure perfections associated with the teaching of St. Anselm. The ratio of such perfections may be without blemish, but their modi significandi leave them only pointing to rather than properly expressing God's perfections, which are their source. Still, despite the creature's perfections gesturing towards without actually expressing the divine perfection, St. Thomas clearly believes that his analogical teaching of divine names does not fall foul of any fallacy of equivocation, though he never does explain exactly how this is the case. Dun Scotus, though beginning in his logical writings more or less with Aquinas' picture of semantic analogy, eventually discards both legitimacy of semantic analogy and the equivocity of the concept of being in favor of univocity. His reasons for doing so are ultimately twofold. First, were we to have no such univocal concepts, our knowledge of both God and the world would be severely compromised. Second, the doctrine of logical univocity is required to explain how our inferential mode of knowing things, both created and uncreated things, is epistemically grounded. Scotus does not deny metaphysical analogy. Those are the attributions he's talking about. He doesn't deny it at the mental level. He doesn't deny it at the transcendental level, contrary to what you read in the press, as it were. And we've seen the text. That is, he does not deny the so-called analogia entis, considered as a metaphysical claim, what he himself tends to call the unity of attribution. He simply argues that such a unity is compatible with abstraction and applicability of univocal concepts. Aquinas and Scotus agree on at least the following. Our knowledge of God does not involve fallacies of equivocation, but they disagree on how to account for that. They agree on knowledge of creaturely perfections as disclosed through sense experience being the ground for our naming God and knowing God in the way that we do. They disagree about how that works. They outright disagree without any qualification about how names work and how naming is to be understood as helpful or unhelpful towards metaphysical analysis. And they disagree on this point whether we're talking about divine or ordinary names. Yet, their accounts of what we can be truly affirmed of God within the scope of natural reason are remarkably similar. Finally, a little noticed point in what I'm writing the book on. Scotus is actually trying to uphold an epistemological outlook rather similar to that of Aquinas, but he's just much more methodologically conscious about what the presuppositions are for that outlook, not least because of the extensive discussion of Aquinas' views on epistemology in the late 13th century. Thank you.
Very much. We've got time for some questions. Good. Dr. Carl again goes first.
Thank you. That was really wonderful.
Thank you.
I, as especially appreciated the way that you presented the text from SCOTUS, the text that you're having.
Uh-huh.
You know, the commodity stream, they grant univocity in their teaching, but they, you know, they grant it by the procedure. But
right. Right. He describes pretty beautifully the remodio technique and how you get to this thin business and you attribute it. His whole point is when you do that, right, you're assuming there's some meaning left, such that to affirm and deny God would be a contradiction.
Okay. So
once you've got that point, say God is good and say God is not good is are contradictory propositions, unsquare opposition. Yeah, that's his point. Yeah. And that's all his point is that you've got to hold on to that. Otherwise, two things. He should suffer from one of the arguments against Henry. Otherwise, we don't attribute anything to God. Right? I mean, all these predications will become God identity statements. And with no epistemic access to predicates, which is what he says. Right? Or they fall woefully short, in which case we're not saying anything of God. Whereas he thinks it's the case when we get through that procedure. Now, mind you, he would back this all the way up. In other words, he would back this up to where we infer God's existence. Because you know how far back this would go. There too, univocity would be assumed.
So I have a question about how Scotus's idea fits with the idea that thought and the world are immortal. So here's the sort of question I have. If the thoughts we have from, or so to speak, the existence in, you know, in some vague aristotelian sense, the existence in our minds of forms that also exist in the world, then you might think that if God and creatures don't have anything metaphysically in common,
mm-hmm.
then therefore the concepts would also have to have nothing in common.
You might.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, and then you would just have to bite the bullet and say, we just don't know anything about God, these arguments don't work, blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, Scotus wants to avoid that.
Right.
But how do you get the univocal concept? Sorry, if you think that thought is grounded in the world,
mm-hmm.
how do you get the univocal concept if the realities don't have anything shared?
Because the one generates a concept that actually applies to the other. The concept of being, in other words, is the likeness.
Spell that out. Like, what generates what, blah, blah.
Well, the first concept you get for Scotus, like Aquinas, like for Henry, is the concept of being. Mind you, very few people think that concept. In fact, the set of people who actually think that concept consciously is coextensive with the metaphysicians in the world, which
right.
grounds Scotus are the fewest of all philosophers.
Right, right.
Okay. So, but don't forget, Scotus is a different kind of mind, right? Abstraction is not the same act as thinking. So for Dan Scotus, I've got jillions, who knows how many, of intelligible species in my mind that is in the possible intellect, which he calls the memoria, that have not yet generated an actual act of thought.
Right.
Okay, so one of the notes we get is being.
Okay.
And being, right, is a notion such that it applies to God and to creature.
I'm just wondering how it could do that. I mean, obviously that Scotus thinks that it does do that.
Well,
how could it if there's nothing in common between the two?
Well, you use this all the time with we see this all the time with second order notions, right? If I have a notion, for example, of something moving a certain way, right? It could be something in China now is moving that way. It doesn't have something in common. It's just the notion of this thing moving that way and that thing moving that way. Right? The description fits both of them.
Well, they're both in motion, right?
Right, but my point is that it's not
that's in common.
Right, but my point is that, you don't need some two things to share a species or animals in order to fit a certain description.
But they have to share some metaphysically. In the example,
their aptitude causes a certain concept. That's all they call they. It's see the thing about being is that he thinks it's a simple concept. You know, you can't get being from something else. It's basic.
Seems like we might have someone who wants to intervene over here just briefly. In a form of a question, if possible.
My apologies for that. Is this thing on?
Yeah.
Okay, good. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding of the motion argument is that it's similar to the bodies. That if you say that body is predicated of myself and Dr. Noon, we're not actually saying that Dr. Noon and I ontologically share the same body. There's no part of our bodies that, you know, are both his body and my body. Our bodies don't participate in one another, in other words. But the notion of body that you could abstract from either my body or Dr. Noon's body could apply equally well to both. Am I understanding that?
That's right. When Scotus has to describe the distinction between God and creature, it's by mode. Right. In the De Anima questions, the first time he goes through, he tries to use difference in the language of genus and species. He discards it thereafter because it doesn't capture things well enough.
On this point?
Oh, yeah. Because this is where the fun starts.
Yeah.
This is the big difference. So a related text, walk me through text 8, because I think this is where we get kind of ground of the big difference between a Thomas and a Scotus. And it's precisely a stomach, and I think you're right. I mean, it's precisely because, logically speaking, obviously, we're going to have concepts for Aquinas' system. And what was particularly interesting to me, from the extent point of view, is the concept of substance, right?
Right.
So,
mm-hmm.
And I think this is the crucial issue. Now, I take it that for Aquinas, and for following Aristotle, obviously, we have the nous poieticos and the nous poieticos.
Right.
And then we have, obviously, the poieticos, which allows for the reception, the pathé of the nous poieticos, and the understanding of the substance is through the impression, and Aquinas gives us a long account of this in the De Veritate, on the impression of the species and intelligibilis on the nous, on the, this, which are weak terms, the pseudolent,
Yes, these are Aquinas uses, yeah.
Right. I don't know why the Greek was coming out. But in any case, and so what we have is we get the species. There is a substance there. There is no for Aquinas.
Well, actually, Aquinas is really opaque on this. I have a paper on this, right? The discussion of the knowability of substance from Aquinas down to just the generation before Scotus. He's really opaque because he talks, and this is where Giles Rome takes him.
Right.
Giles takes it that he has a specious substantiae in the intellect.
Oh, right. Well, that's
yeah,
true.
But Aquinas actually thinks, as far as I can tell, especially towards the end, that it's inferential. He's going towards an inferential model.
Well,
right.
He is, but,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Right. An impression.
That's what's behind this. By the way, the guy who's behind this particular paragraph is Richard Mediavilla. Discussion of Richard Mediavilla on the nobility of substance is like the masterful
right,
discussion.
Right, but
yeah.
Let's just take the kind of the negative concept where he's talked about, I think, more completely than does in the Soma, but that's a different issue.
Yeah.
So the idea is that I can have the impression of the specious and sensibilis on my possible intellect, And that's how I know a thing. So I don't have to, the notion of substance. Now, here I take it to be that Scotus has a radically different thing.
Right. He has, well, in two respects.
Right.
Again, because of Richard Mediavilla.
Right.
You have two things going on. For Scotus, you have constant being. Experience reveals that some beings, I mean the accents which begin, are in another. And that's because of variation in experience, right?
Right.
You see this with children. At first, they don't have any seem to have any notion of substance at all, but then eventually they start to seem to have an idea of it. The psychologists call this an idea of persistence, if you study their stuff. Let's talk about. For Scotus, what goes on there is that we get strange enough, as this normative notion, a notion of entia in alio, because there are many accidents revealed through sense experience. And then we get a notion of ens in se, and that's a transcendental notion. It's that transcendental notion that lets us then build up a compound notion of a given type of substance. In other words, actually, this is a relatively compressed treatment. He's talking both in general terms about the transcendental notion of substance and the notion of a substance, say dog substance, cat substance. In both these cases for Scotus, the condition for the possibility we have that notion is just that we already have the notion of being, and hence, as regards, say, a dog substance, what we get is this transcendental notion of being guiding our thinking, and then all these properties, there must be an entity that fits these descriptions in this way. And then we start ordering, at that point for Scotus, like with Aquinas, we start ordering predicates, a priority, posteriority, complex nervous system, right vertebrate, all that good stuff. But for Scotus, unlike, and this point is very clear compared to Aquinas, most human beings, and I mean to include people we would normally consider to be pretty high order knowers, mathematicians, physicists, for example, do not understand what they study in any profound sense. And here's why, as you understand this, if you want to succeedingly radical claim, the answer is because they don't know the ontological status of what they study. And it usually gives the example of a mathematician, but once in a while it would be a physicist, and the same point is made, namely, they have not thought the concept of being as a transcendental, consciously, even though being is in their intellects. And this is his famous doctrine, at least I've made it famous, of habitual cognition. And that's what underlies all these inferences. So it's not like they think substance. So this is one of the first critiques of this, by the way, by the Augustinian author, was that he's talking about a quo epistemically. And I think there's a lot of Gerald Bologna basis criticism. And that's right, I think. Gerald Bologna is right. Scotus is most of the time talking about the notion of being as a quo, as an epistemic quo, whereby we know the world. That's this key thing here. That's Gerald's complaint, was that it's true about that quo, right? But it's so that's what, actually, I don't know what people are saying how profound it is. Yeah, but the point is that if Scotus is right, the set of metaphysicians is extremely small. So even though from a purely, as it were, masterful point of view, all these distinctions would have to be made, very few people need to make those distinctions to do the science they do. As Scotus points out himself, mathematicians don't really care at the end of the day whether a triangle is a substance or a quantity or a quality or whatever. And they can go on perfectly well without knowing that. But that means at the end of the day, they don't know what they're talking about from a metaphysical point of view. And that's the entailment of that. And that's just why there's a thing like the philosophy of mathematics, right? Because you need to articulate that. That's what Scotus thinks. And so this is, but you're quite right. There are two notions of substance. One is properly transcendental, and that's expressed simply as ens in se versus ens in alio. Right? But don't forget, in the order of cognition, we're beginning with the entia in alio. Right? And that's his point. How do we get to the notion of substance? If we didn't have a transcendental notion of substance, we couldn't make those inferences we make about underlying subjects being such and such a sort, blah, blah, blah. And so it's operative as a quo, and that's where Gerald Bologna is making this criticism.
Joining me in thanking him for his very fine work.